lower-income local folks share the food they have gathered with households in need. You can find Local Folks at KBOO.FM. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series called KBOO at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. That's pugspdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is 9:01. And on a Monday, that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgeridge, along with our engineer, Patsy Kohlberg. We call this show The Old Mole, following Karl Marx's image of the revolution that works away underground, undermining and exposing the rotten roots of capitalism, until it, that is the mole, pops up unexpectedly in the manicured lawns of the wealthy. Or to borrow some words from in a different context from Paul Gilroy, the mole is an underground phenomenon that appears suddenly amid the gloss of the cultural industries and their insatiable machinery of commodification. The mole is then the mascot for all of us who work to expose, criticize, and subvert the system of capitalism to which we are all enslaved. We are slaves to the extent that other people, whose interests are not ours, control how we live and whether we shall live or die. For example, the automobile and petroleum industries and the politicians they control are doing their best to prevent actions that could slow the course of global warming, thereby condemning the human species to climate chaos and possible extinction. In a moment, we'll hear about an organization that is working to advance a full-scale and adequate response to climate change. On smaller stages, workers organize to fight back against the many ways employers can abuse them, like wage theft, sexual harassment, and unjustified dismissal. We will be hearing about an IWW effort to organize some restaurant workers in New York. Capitalism is propped up not only by money and arms, but also by teaching a philosophy of individualism and consumerism that distracts us from political organizing. We moles need to be philosophers in order to contest the hegemony of the philosophy that supports capitalism. We'll be hearing more about hegemony and philosophy from Fran Michel's sketch of Antonio Gramsci later in the hour. And finally, I'll have a commentary about capitalism as an ongoing form of slavery. This show will be archived on the KBOO website in a day or two. That's at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can find past shows as well. So if there's a piece you like and want to get your friends to hear it, just send them the link. So first up on today's Old Mole, Bill Resnick is going to talk with Margaret Klein Salomon of the Climate Mobilization. They advocate a World War II-type great mobilization here and around the world to vastly reduce greenhouse gas emissions starting now. The group has just won climate emergency declarations in Berkeley and Richmond, California, and are making headway in Los Angeles. Here's Bill.
Margaret Klein-Salomon, welcome to KABU.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Margaret Klein-Salomon is a co-founder of the organization Climate Mobilization that won several important victories recently in California when the citizens of two cities, Berkeley and Los Angeles, persuaded the city councils to come near adopting climate energy declarations. So, Margaret Salomon, today, August 2nd, record temperatures are killing people across the globe. Huge wildfires driven by strong winds. Absolutely, they can't control them. And then the record temperatures and the drought in California, it's raging across the American West. In co-founding the Climate Mobilization, you and your colleagues examining the climate science predicted this, and this is just, in fact, the start, and it's going to get worse. In reading the mobilization, I realized that your biography and the mobilization are closely intertwined. Tell us about the Climate Mobilization and why you and others got together to found it.
So before I jump into that, let me just say, because I have some late breaking news, which is last week, Richmond, California declared a climate emergency and commit to climate mobilization and also to becoming an advocate for climate mobilization. So, so that's two cities in California who have declared climate emergency. And as you said, we're working in Los Angeles, getting close to getting a climate emergency mobilization department established. What the climate mobilization is, we offer an alternative policy framework and an alternative communications framework for approaching the climate crisis. The climate crisis is it's such a huge problem and a huge threat, and it's going to take such a huge solution. It's basically overwhelmed our existing institutions, including legacy environmental organizations. Virtually no institution in American life has grappled with, reckoned with the real threat of the climate emergency. And right now, because of that, we as a society are committing passive suicide, right? We are going full speed ahead on a path that leads only to collapse, and sooner rather than later.
The sooner rather than later, it seems to me, is the point. Some people say, well, we have a lot of time, and if it really turns out bad, then we have time to do it. But in fact, it's likely to become irreversible. The physics of it is very clear and has been known for 100 years. We could be on a globe that is, in fact, dying and roasting to death, and there's nothing we can do about it.
I would say what's perhaps even more amazing is that what you just said, the kind of maybe we're doomed idea, is not uncommon. It is, in fact, widely shared. And I would say shared by virtually everyone within the legacy climate and environmental movement. There is a feeling, a vast feeling of despair and helplessness. That's what's experienced privately. But then publicly, they say, let's do carbon pricing. Let's enact small policies to tweak the market that will create a gradual reduction in fossil fuels. Simply stated, gradualism, or the idea that we should reduce emissions gradually over the course of decades, it makes no sense. Perhaps that could have worked if we had implemented it 40 years ago. I'm not even sure, but perhaps. But we didn't. And we're at this absolute crisis point now where the climate mobilization is one of the only organizations in the United States that is actually advocating response that is at scale, a response with the aim of protecting humanity and the natural world, avoiding collapse, not some kind of compromised aim of like, yeah, reducing emissions, making the problem slightly less acute. I mean, it's just do or die time, and we need to go all the way.
One of the things that's attracted me to the climate mobilization, I'm one of those thousands of small donors, but what attracts me is that You're confident that it can be done, that the American people will support you. You have marshaled so much information. You say the American people will support you, will support a climate mobilization when they come to recognize how severe it is. And you point to the experience of World War II. And I think it's important to talk to people about that, that the historical record shows that the people will support a real huge mobilization where all of industry is required to, in fact, convert themselves into meeting the threat.
So in World War II, as the war was ramping up in Europe and Asia, the United States was in denial for years. Isolationism, the idea that it's not our war, let's just stay out of, you know, it doesn't affect us. But the bombing at Pearl Harbor created a collective awakening. Even before Pearl Harbor, there was a strong minority in favor of preparedness and war. And even FDR, the president, understood the threat. So it wasn't like Pearl Harbor took us from zero to 100, but it took the need for all-out war from a minority position to a national consensus position. And when the country understood that we have to do this, it's simply not a choice. They are coming for us. We are not safe. We have to do this. That inspired a kind of mode switch or paradigm switch from a kind of consumer society where individuals are out for number one to a mission-driven emergency response society. Social psychologists talk about this phenomenon. It's an evolutionary phenomenon of when under threat, the group can pull together and act more like a unit than a collection of individuals, act with more common intention. So when we did that, when we mobilized and had all hands on deck, all sectors participating, and 40% of vegetables were grown at home in Victory Gardens, and 10% of Americans moved to a different state to work in a war job, and women went into factories for the first time, and cars were banned. The new consumer cars were banned because all of those factories were used to make tanks and planes.
The entire auto industry and plane industry was taken over by the public.
And meat, gasoline, and tires were all rationed through fair shares measures, which were cheerfully accepted by the public because, again, there is a collective understanding. We have no choice. We have to achieve this mission. We have to win this war. And so I'm an optimist. That doesn't cause me to change my estimation of the crisis as an absolute acute existential threat to all life.
And in fact, we might get lucky that we aren't doomed yet. There's real possibilities that people will awake before the irreversibility has occurred. And I think we have to assume that there's no reason to give up. Some of the doomsayers are making a big mistake when they say, well, just live happy, do drugs, and wait for the inevitable. It isn't inevitable, it seems to me, yet, but it could become that.
I think that unless you have this understanding of mobilization, this understanding that humanity does have the capability for collective action towards a common purpose, particularly meeting an existential threat. If you don't understand that concept, then yeah, I can understand why you'd be hopeless. Because market mechanisms and policies that don't bother anyone too much are not going to solve this. However, I'm an optimist in that I really believe in the power of human potential. I think we're incredible geniuses. You know, what we can accomplish in terms of technology, solar, regenerative agriculture, are deepening our understanding of how ecosystems work and carbon drawdown. We can do amazing things. We just haven't tried any kind of reasonable scale. It's still a tiny portion of humanity that's working on these problems when we need all hands on deck.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm talking to Margaret Klein Salomon, one of the founders of the climate mobilization. We've discussed the climate mobilization, in fact, a kind of World War II wartime mobilization to use all of the technologies we already developed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to zero very quickly and maybe save the planet. Margaret, another reason that seems to me for optimism is we have all the technologies and the know-how. They are operating now today. It's not as if we have to learn how to reforest. It's not as if regenerative agriculture is not, in fact, the principles of it are well known. Now, the industrial growers don't want to do it because it's different than their system of using pesticides and lots of fossil fuels and all the rest to level great areas of the world and plant them in monocrops, and they make a lot of money doing that. But there are lots of farmers all over the world, movements of farmers in the United States who are using regenerative methods. And that's also true of energy production. We could ramp up renewable energy production so rapidly. Every contractor in the United States, every small little company knows how to put up solar panels. Anybody who built a kitchen, it's so much more complicated than putting in solar panels. We could, in fact, both conserve electricity enormously and make cities self-sufficient very quickly, even cities with a lot of cloud cover.
Buckminster Fuller said, the future is here, it's just not widely distributed or evenly distributed. So what you're saying is exactly right. We have the solutions that we need to put in place to eliminate emissions and draw down excess emissions, because we're already too hot. We're already at 410 parts per million. So we already have it. I mean, talking about technological breakthroughs, these inevitably will come even at a faster rate if we focus our collective understanding and energy on solving this problem rather than creating the next best iPhone and the improving consumer goods, which is how our economy is focused now. But you're absolutely right. We certainly should not be waiting for technological advancement. What we need to do more than anything is implement renewable energy, regenerative agriculture, zero carbon, regenerative economy, zero waste. We need to be implementing that at scale. That is the huge challenge, because energy revolutions or any kind of change in how the economy and society works, these usually take longer, and they do, and especially to achieve like the level of penetration that we need now, which is like 100%. We're already making this transition, but it's just way, way, way too slow. The climate mobilization wants to take all of these solutions and scale them up to 1,000 or 10,000 times the scale they're at now and just implement them all over the country as fast as possible.
What about the rest of the world? The U.S. is sort of semi-plateaued in terms of, although we're still the biggest polluter, although China, I guess, has passed us in some ways. What about the rest of the world? I think the Europeans are ready to act, actually. The European society is far more aware than the U.S. right now. What about China and India? It seems to me we have to share our wealth, both technology and money. It's not just a matter of electrifying the United States and growing forests here and doing regenerative agriculture here. There are 20 other countries in the world where if they adopted the program, the problem could well be solved. But it's not just a U.S. problem, though.
Right, absolutely. While we focus our campaigning in the United States, you're absolutely right, it's just one piece of the puzzle. But I feel that being an American, you kind of have to lead where you are, and understanding the United States' huge level of responsibility for creating this crisis and stepping into a role like what we're asking the country to do, basically a 180 and lead in a totally different direction than the fossil fuel, consumer economy, industrialized agriculture direction that we've been spreading across the globe for decades. The power of American leadership surely has been degraded by the Trump administration, but if we achieve this mobilization, I think the world would say, basically, oh, what have you been waiting for? We've wanted to do this. We're very interested in this. We understand the scale of the problem. but you guys have been blocking progress, and now, okay, you're really willing to take this on. Okay, we will join you. And the climate mobilization, we call for the United States to bring the world to zero emissions plus drawdown by 2030, our top foreign policy priority. And I mean, it makes sense. Everything the climate mobilization advocates for is, on one hand, like it sounds so radical and like it could never happen. It's amazing. And then on the other hand, it's just common sense. Of course, our top foreign policy priority should be to decarbonize the planet. If we don't do that, no one is safe. We have to achieve that if we want to continue to survive and have a chance at thriving as a species here on this planet. So absolutely, technology sharing, direct aid, we cannot solve this problem in isolation. But I believe that if the United States steps up to solve it, that we will not be alone.
You know, Margaret, one thing we didn't talk about is the problem of capitalist elites just refuse to give up power. They don't want to, and right now they're trying to eliminate any government, any public control of their activities, and they've done really well over the last 40 years. They've succeeded, actually, in so many ways, and they're not going to give up, and it's going to be a struggle. But the people will win the struggle, and even the military is likely to stand with the people rather than the elites. The military knows, in fact, how serious this is in their threat assessments. So I think we really do have a chance. You're devoting your life to that. One final thing that we should talk about, Berkeley, Los Angeles, and Richmond.
Two cities in California, Berkeley and Richmond, have now both declared climate emergency, commit to World War II scale climate mobilization, and called for the state and national governments to do the same, to initiate an emergency climate mobilization that eliminates emissions as quickly as possible and protects humanity in the natural world. So that is very exciting. That's following Hoboken, New Jersey, and Montgomery County, Maryland, which did the same in late 2017. And then in Los Angeles, we are close to getting a climate emergency mobilization department up and running. We have $500,000 allocated for it in the budget, that this department would be in charge of overseeing Los Angeles's transition, rapid transition to zero emissions, and also would act as an advocate to the state level, to other cities, and ultimately going nationally. We really think that working locally has a lot of advantages. It's the least corporate-controlled arm of government. It's the most accessible to citizens, and cities are getting hit so hard by the climate crisis. But we're really looking to push cities to go beyond their kind of traditional role. Usually when you think about climate action in cities, you think about cities reducing their emissions. And yes, we want to do that. However, no city can solve this problem. So the idea of city as advocate, working to spread the need for emergency climate mobilization to other cities and to higher levels of government is, I think, a really compelling strategic tactic.
Allegedly green and clean Portland that's done so well in advertising itself as the city of the future, which it isn't, because, in fact, entirety of the political elite in this state looks to the two big investor-owned utilities here who are very clever to lead the way, and they are, of course, starting to stop everything. We don't even have net metering here in Portland, Oregon. But that's another matter that can be solved, actually, if the people rise up here a little bit. And we have something on the ballot to create an emergency fund here in Portland. So things are looking up here a little bit. Margaret Salomon, it was really good talking to you. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, and I just want to put in an invitation to all listeners to come to our website, theclimatemobilization.org, and get involved. You can volunteer, organize your city. This is time for everyone to realize that no one is coming to save us. We have to do it.
I have lived for love, but now that's not enough. Friend, no friend of mine. Friends, we're out of time, and it's slowly.
That's Julian Lennon with Saltwater here on KBOO's Old Mole Variety Hour. And before that, we heard Margaret Salomon of the Climate Mobilization talking with Bill Resnick about the need for a serious national and international reorganization of our economy to save the planet from climate disaster. Stay tuned for an introduction to the thought of Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist philosopher who said we are all philosophers, and who put the concept of hegemony to work in analyzing capitalist society. Right now, though, Marianne Labat will be talking with the Old Mole's Joe Clement about Stardust Family United, the union formed by singer servers at Ellen's Stardust Diner with the help of the New York branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. Though they won a big settlement ahead of taking their employer to the National Labor Relations Board last year, Marianne stresses the importance of direct action and solidarity union organizing in getting the workers what they need.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined again by IWW organizer Marianne Labat, coming all the way out from New York over the phone. Thank you, Marianne.
Thanks for having me again.
So I wanted to talk a bit about an organizing campaign project that you've been involved with at Ellen's Stardust Diner in Times Square, New York.
It's been there for about 40 years, family business, and it's in all the guidebooks, and it's a famous tourist attraction. It's the place where the waiters sing while they're serving. So they sing Broadway show tunes, they sing Disney classics, they sing pop songs, they sing whatever they want, and it's like this wonderful sort of camp show that goes on in the restaurant. It's like getting dinner and a show at the same time. And the people who work there usually work there for a number of years, and they come back to the restaurant in between working on Broadway shows or going on tours or working on cruise lines or whatever. So they are performers. But, you know, many performers work service, especially restaurant jobs, to make ends meet in between performances, and these guys do that, but it's a way of them being able to continue performing in between performances as well.
That's a great work-life balance, too. I understand that all changed a couple few years ago with a change in management at the diner. Could you speak to that?
I mean, yes. So first of all, I want to apologize because normally when these opportunities come our way to talk about the campaign, I let a worker field them, but due to miscommunication and whatnot, I wasn't able to do that today. But as a worker was just relaying at an event earlier this week, they were always having problems with management. I mean, the restaurant industry in New York is pretty brutal. People get treated pretty poorly. There's everything from wage theft to harassment to unsafe working conditions. And they had faced all of those conditions in the diner for years. But in January of 2016, the owners of the restaurant handed management of the restaurant over to a new group, which came in and really started kind of bullying the staff. And one of the things they were doing was firing people at the rate of one or two a week, long-standing employees. And they had a captive health insurance program, so the employer was selling the employees health insurance, and there seemed to be a lot of firing of people who had the audacity to use the health insurance, like by having children. So discriminatory, bullying behavior, and the staff, you know, looked around at each other and said, this is unacceptable. And a couple people, one person in particular, spearheaded the campaign and began reaching out to unions to help them stand up to the boss and to stand up for their rights.
And why do you think they went with the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, and have stuck with them?
So they actually reached out to other unions first. One of them they reached out to was Actors Equity Association, which represents Broadway performers. And, you know, they were familiar with it, so they reached out to them, and Actors Equity, to my understanding, turned them down in part because they're not actually employed as performers. They're employed as servers. And just like any other server, they make less than minimum wage because the minimum wage is deducted against by, I think, tips, right? And so they are paid just like any other server. So Actors Equity, from my understanding, didn't want to take them on for that reason because they weren't technically employed as performers. And I believe they reached out to other, like, service industry unions, but were turned down by them as well for for whatever reason, you know, like maybe because they're considered a small shop, or, you know, unions usually decide for themselves what organizing projects to take on rather than just accepting whatever comes their way. And so then they called the IWW and we took them on. And it ended up being this really wonderful relationship and partnership where we were looking for organizing opportunities and, you know, they needed somebody to help them out. And so we started helping them with their campaign.
And what did that look like, helping them out?
So in the beginning, it involved running, we have an organizer training program. It is a 2-day skills building workshop where we take people from having no previous organizing experience whatsoever to learning how to have conversations with their coworkers in the workplace that will build what we call a committee. So in other words, a group of workers who are paying attention to workplace conditions and willing to act on them in solidarity with one another to get their needs met. And so we would run this training with them every, let's say, month or two. And after that, we also had a committee of 3 people from the New York branch of the IWW, you know, talking to them and consulting with them and mentoring them in general. And so we provided guidance and we provided skills and tools, but from the beginning, it's really been their campaign and they make the decisions and they are the committee. We give them advice, but it's absolutely run by the workers themselves.
And what did that look like in terms of the boss's response to union activity?
So what's funny is that the very first action they took on had to do with something called the tip bucket. So there's a bucket that gets circulated among patrons in the restaurant every, let's say, hour or so. And it's the only way that they get paid for singing. And so there's a master of ceremonies, and the master of ceremonies would circulate this bucket among patrons and explain that, you know, this helps support their classes and they're supporting themselves as artists. And management, for who knows what reason, decided to take it away. And so the staff did what we call a march on the boss, where it was this beautiful moment. They sang My Shot from Hamilton to get to, like, be the signal to each other and raise their ketchups in the air in this display of power. And then 5 or 6 servers just walked up to a manager and demanded that they be given their bucket back. And, you know, it makes a big difference in terms of their income, too. That thing collects, you know, $200 a shift. And management conceded, and within 24 hours, they had their bucket back. In fact, within 5 hours, management made a commitment to give it back to them. And that happened while they were still underground. So they were obviously building that committee. They were having those conversations with each other, but they hadn't yet told the employer that they were a union, and they hadn't yet come out publicly as a union. And they won on that, and that didn't come with immediate retaliation. I think that a lot of times when workers take action at work, even collective action, it scares the boss, but the boss does not necessarily, like, cotton on to the fact that this is union activity, even though it falls entirely within the National Labor Relations Act's definition of union activity, 2 or more workers coming together and taking action to improve conditions in the workplace. But later, the workers did go public in the form of a very big story in the New York Times, and that reporter contacted the owner for comment about the fact that he had a union in his workplace, and he had no idea. After that, there were tremendous retaliations. The employer hired a union-busting law firm, and there would be what we call captive audience meetings, so mandatory staff meetings where you get told all the reasons that unions are terrible. And there would be harassment. People would receive, like, anonymous threatening text messages. And worst of all, there were 16 people fired in the space of about 4 days in September, just a few weeks after they went public.
Wow. And those firings are what most people will find the most about if they just search Stardust Diner Google News. But what you're saying is that there was a lot more activity, a lot more retaliatory activity, but then also a lot more wins than just this settlement over the illegal firings when they threatened to bring it before the National Labor Relations Board.
Yeah, so after that initial batch of firings in September, there was then, unfortunately, another batch of firings in January, and again, it was about 15 people. And so the employer was really trying to fire away the committee, trying to fire away the union, which is a very, very common way that employers react. As I said, there had been firings at the rate of about one or two a week prior to this, but these firings were obviously concentrated on getting rid of this union problem. And the thing to be aware of is that technically that is against the law. The Labor Relations Act says you cannot be retaliated against, whether it's firing or just messing with your schedule or whatever, if you are engaging in concerted protected activity, union activity, to defend your rights at work. But the reality is that employers look at that and they make a calculation and decide that it's worth it, as they did in the Stardust case. And so we, of course, took that to the National Labor Relations Board with the help of our very talented labor lawyer, Ben Dichter, who was working for us pro bono, thank goodness. And ultimately, after a process that took about a year, all of those terminations were reversed. And when the boss fired those people, he made up accusations of theft as the reason why he fired people, as opposed to for organizing. We got him to retract those claims and expunge everyone's record and invite everybody who had been fired to come back to work. Plus, he had to give them all back pay for the time that they were not employed at the diner. So we had a huge legal victory, which we won through legal means, but also by continuing to place a tremendous amount of pressure on the employer, both inside and outside the restaurant. And by that I mean there were actions continuously being taken inside the restaurant to fight for workers' rights, showing the employer that no matter how many firings you engage in, we will continue to act as a union and have each other's backs and take action to improve conditions at work. And then the outside actions were like pickets, protests, pickets that prevented delivery of supplies to the restaurant, flyering, leafleting, encouraging customers to go to a non-union busing restaurant, that kind of protest activity. So our legal case ended in a settlement as opposed to before actually going to a formal NLRB trial. The National Labor Relations Board supervised that settlement, but it ended in a negotiated settlement, which kind of tells you that the employer at some point decided to cut his losses and realized that he wasn't going to win. And that had a lot to do with the pressure that we kept up through direct action. But yes, to answer your question, there's always been a lot of direct action activity going on inside the restaurant to improve conditions, which is a somewhat separate story from the legal case that people will probably most likely find in headlines.
I remember reading something that you posted on Facebook about how the workers won a lactation room for new mothers. Could you speak about what that issue was and how they won it?
So that's a great example of what the difference is between having an active union in the workplace and not, and between taking direct action versus relying on legal processes. So it's law in New York State that employers have to provide what's called a lactation room where new moms can express breast milk, and it can't be a restroom in any workplace, plus give them the time to pump. The employer at Ellen Stardust Diner, the boss, not only hadn't provided that, but he'd actually been sued in the past successfully for not providing that, and continued to not provide that. So again, we tend to think that the law will protect us, like it's not illegal to organize at work, you can't be fired for it, wage theft is illegal, unsafe working conditions are illegal, not having lactation room is illegal, and yet employers voluntarily skirt those laws all the time, and the only people we really have to enforce them is us ourselves. So that was the case in the past with Stardust Diners. They would not provide that lactation room. Now that there's a very active union, we had a worker who gave birth a couple of months ago. She had a lovely baby girl. And when she returned to work, she was immediately brought by the manager to her lovely lactation room, which is entirely hers. You know, it doesn't double as an office. It's got some nice, comfortable chairs in there. And he was, like, anxious to show it off to her, because now they're so afraid of the union that they do whatever they can to keep workers happy. So again, you know, it's the difference between having a union and not. It's the difference between what the law will do versus what direct action will do. And there are many other examples besides that.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this on-air portion of my conversation with Marianne Labatt, IWW organizer with Stardust Family United. If you tune in to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, you can hear Marianne talk a bit more about how they use direct action to get what they need at the Stardust Diner in New York. Thanks again, Marianne, for coming to talk to us on the Old Mole.
Thanks for having me again.
I'd like to lead out with a song written by a Stardust Family United member, Max Deemers, covered here by Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine. It's called The Tower.
There was a shining tower sitting high upon a hill, and the people in its shadow gave their all to serve its will. The tower, it was beautiful, the people, they were good. Said the people to the tower, we will praise you as we should. People rose up, singing, thank you God for this unearthly thing. Yeah, they rose up, till the heavens of your majesty will sing. They sang, we are the people, we sing as one. We sing for all the beauty here and all the good that can be done. Yes, we are the people and we stand strong. We stand for who we are and what we may become. We are.
And as Joe said, that's The Tower by Max Deemer, one of the singing servers at Ellen's Stardust Diner, where the activism of workers organized through the IWW are winning their struggle with management. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO in Portland. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Well, one of the most important thinkers after Marx, who extended our understanding of capitalism and how it shapes our lives, was the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, whose life was shortened by a long prison term imposed by Mussolini. Here's the Old Mole's Fran Michel to tell us who he was and why he is important.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with the Well-Read Red. I've been thinking lately of the often-cited motto of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, to the effect that what leftists require is pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. We need to recognize the potentially daunting complexity and power of the situation we are working to change, and yet remain undaunted about the possibility of changing it. Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, was a perspective Gramsci had reason to know something about. Born in Italy in 1891, Gramsci, spelled G-R-A-M-S-C-I, grew up poor but won a scholarship to the University of Turin, where he developed his interests in socialism. He lived through the success of the Russian Revolution in 1917 and the failure of the like to happen in the rest of Europe. Co-founder of the Italian Communist Party in 1921, Gramsci saw the rise to power in Italy of Mussolini's fascism, and after Mussolini outlawed the Communist Party in 1926, Gramsci spent most of the rest of his life in prison. The writing he did there before his death in 1937 came to light only many years later, but Gramsci's prison notebooks have been an important resource for those seeking to understand the persistence of capitalism, the rise of fascism, and the possibilities of socialism. Gramsci's re-examinations of Marx emphasize that changing socioeconomic circumstances do not of themselves produce political changes. Gramsci resisted dogmatic or abstract conceptions of Marxism and simplistic notions of the economic base determining the social or cultural superstructure. Instead, he emphasized the creativity of everyday culture, the intellectual capacities of all people, the importance of ideology and ideological struggles in creating political alliances, and the contradictions existing in every historical moment. In his essay on the study of philosophy, which appears in his prison notebooks, Gramsci observes, quote, "It is essential to destroy the widespread prejudice that philosophy is a strange and difficult thing just because it is the specific intellectual activity of a particular category of specialists or of professional and systematic philosophers. It must first be shown that all people are philosophers by defining the limits and characteristics of the spontaneous philosophy which is proper to everybody. This philosophy is contained in, for instance, language itself, which is a totality of determined notions and concepts and not just of words grammatically devoid of content." End quote. Well, he didn't say that exactly. He said or wrote something like that, but in Italian. translations are sometimes vexed. Slavoj Žižek has quoted Gramsci as saying in 1930, "The old world is dying, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." But what he actually said translates more literally as, "The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear." Žižek apparently translated a loose French translation back into English, and I confess I quite like the more colorful version. But to return to Gramsci's comments on the question of language more directly, he notes that everyone is a philosopher, though in their own way and unconsciously, since even in the slightest manifestation of any intellectual activity whatever in language, there is contained a specific conception of the world. And then, quote, "One proceeds to the question, is it better to think without having critical awareness in a disjointed and episodic way? In other words, is it better to take part in a conception of the world mechanically imposed by one of the many social groups in which everyone is automatically involved from the moment of entry into the conscious world? Or on the other hand, is it better to work out consciously and critically one's own conception of the world and thus, in connection with the labors of one's own brain, choose one's sphere of activity, take an active part in the creation of the history of the world, and not simply to accept passively and without care the imprint of one's own personality from outside," end quote. As you might guess, Gramsci endorses that active and critical approach to conceiving of the world. But though it relies on the labors of one's own brain, it's also a social and political process, since one's conception of the world develops in interaction with the available ideas, shapes one's actions, and influences what vision of the world one will give one's consent to. Gramsci is perhaps best known for stressing the notion of hegemony. This is an idea of cultural and intellectual as well as political and economic dominance, in which social practice is seen to depend on consent to certain dominant ideas, which in fact express the needs of a dominant class. Raymond Williams, in his book Keywords, offers a brief account of hegemony. Quote, "In its simplest use, it extends the notion of political predominance from relations between states to relations between classes, as in bourgeois hegemony. But the character of this predominance is not limited to matters of direct political control, but seeks to describe a more general predominance, which includes, as one of its key features, a particular way of seeing the world and human nature and relationships. These ways of seeing the world and ourselves and others are not just intellectual but political facts, expressed over a range from institutions to relationships and consciousness. Hegemony depends for its hold not only on its expression of the interests of a ruling class, but also on its acceptance as normal reality or common sense by those in practice subordinated to it. In this view, revolution is not just the transfer of political or economic power, but the overthrow of a specific hegemony. That is to say, an integral form of class rule, which exists not only in political and economic institutions and relationships, but also in active forms of experience and consciousness. This can only be done, it is argued, by creating an alternative hegemony, a new predominant practice and consciousness." End quote. In that essay on the study of philosophy, Gramsci writes, quote, "Creating a new culture does not only mean one's own individual original discoveries. It means also and especially the diffusion in a critical form of truths already discovered, socializing them, as it were, and even making them the basis of vital action." End quote. This diffusion of critical truths as the basis for vital action is part of what we try to accomplish on The Old Mole. For The Well-Read Red, this is Fran Michel, wishing you pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will.
Thank you, Fran, for that very useful introduction to Gramsci, who repays constant reading and rereading. Well, to close out today's show, I have a commentary that lays out the fundamental problem we face today, the one that I think conditions all the others, that we are slaves to capital. When Sandhya Hartman visited Ghana some years ago to follow the tracks of the slave trade in Africa, she was told by an African-American who had lived there for many years, "Soon the Europeans will own all of it again. Do you think slavery is just some old buildings and dead folks? No, it's when other people decide whether you live or die." American history is often presented as a long upward climb towards freedom. The Declaration of Independence said that all men are created equal and endowed with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Originally, of course, all men was taken to include only white men who owned property. And, of course, that excluded all women, all non-Europeans, especially native people, and people of African ancestry. Most of the latter were enslaved and were intended by the founders to stay that way. But so the story goes, over the next two centuries, the nation struggled to grow into its image of itself as the land of the free. The abolition movement and the Civil War put an end to slavery. The suffragists succeeded in winning the right to vote for women. The civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s liberated African Americans from the shackles of Jim Crow. And the women's movement made progress toward the goal of equal treatment and opportunities for women. So while it was hypocritical to call the U.S. a free country at its birth, it's close to being one now. Now this story of a largely successful campaign for freedom is increasingly difficult to believe. The police regularly harass, arrest, and kill people with only imaginary provocation. Women and people of color are commonly denied equal pay for equal work and equal opportunities for advancement. Latinos and Latinas are regularly harassed and terrorized by government agents. People with darker skins pay more to borrow money. Women and children are frequently enslaved for sex and unpaid labor. And we could go on and on. But what I want to focus on is the kind of slavery that is so common and pervasive that we don't even see it. The slavery captured by the remark I quoted at the beginning. Slavery is when other people decide whether you live or die. The people of Ghana are not free if everything is owned by Europeans. In other words, freedom is not just a matter of political rights granted by the state, or civil rights, the right to be treated equally regardless of your ancestry or your gender or sexual orientation. Freedom is also a matter of who owns and controls the conditions of life, the kinds of work we can do, under what conditions and for what wages, what kind of food, housing, transportation, and entertainment are available and at what cost. When we go to work, we come under the rule of the boss and the business or agency he or she represents. We are not usually whipped or beaten for not meeting the boss's requirements, but we can be punished in other ways, including the loss of our livelihood. Moreover, though we may be able, depending on the state of the market, to choose to work for a different boss, we cannot, unless we are independently wealthy, have the option of not working for wages at all. These two factors, needing to work for wages in order to live, and needing to obey our masters as we work, make it appropriate to call ourselves, as Marx did, wage slaves. It seems, then, that it's only when we are off work that we are free, though how much free time we can have depends often on the demands of our employer. We may have to be available on a moment's notice to go to work, or the wages we are paid and the cost of living may require us to work overtime or work two or more jobs. For the most part, we have very little voice in how much we are paid or what it costs to buy housing, food, clothing, and other necessities. So here, too, we are slaves in the sense that other people decide not just whether we will live or die, but how we live. We are not legally owned, as chattel slaves are, but our lives belong to us only at the margins, in the few hours we can manage to do things we really care about. And even in our so-called leisure time, the culture and entertainment available for us is produced by people answerable not to us or people like us, but to the owners and managers of corporate capital, whose only goal is holding on to and growing their wealth and power. And their wealth, don't forget, is not a product of their labor, but ours. Our share of that wealth we produced is paid out in wages that steadily lose their value relative to the cost of living. Meanwhile, the profits of not working, but merely owning things, climbs to record levels. We suppose that slavery is over. It belongs to the past. Well, we're not chattel slaves, so we think we are free. We live in a democracy, not a tyranny, so we call ourselves free. We have basic political rights, like the right to assemble and the right to speak our minds, at least in theory, if often not in practice. But our democracy is highly controlled by the rich and powerful. Governments, especially the national government, does not represent those of us whose only input is to vote for which member of which ruling class party shall pretend to represent us. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels claim that the executive of the modern state is nothing but a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. Well, today it is not just the executive, but the legislative and judicial branches that work to facilitate the extraction of wealth from the people. Consider the climate crisis. As we heard earlier on today's show from the climate mobilization, only the federal government could conceivably marshal the resources and the authority to take the actions necessary to prevent the climate catastrophes coming at us. But the petroleum and related industries have managed to delay and water down every serious attempt to slow down or stop the accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere. The accumulation of capital comes first. Those who manage and defend that accumulation are the others who decide whether and when and how we shall live. We are, then, slaves of capital. Nevertheless, we can think. We are all, as Gramsci pointed out, philosophers, in spite of ourselves, and we have the power to rethink the hegemony we are living under, the hegemony of profits, private property, and individualism that keeps us in our self-destructive course. As optimists of the spirit, we claim that a way of life is possible and indeed necessary, a life in which we are not slaves of any kind, a world in which we cooperatively and together decide how to live. Working together for our common future, we can make a future of freedom possible, a world in which we not only survive, but flourish. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Arise, ye whips, from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.
And that's going to be it for the Old Mole today. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest Margaret Klein Salomon for their discussion of what a real climate program looks like. To Marianne Labatt and Joe Clement for letting us know what real labor activism looks like. And to Fran Michel for reminding us of the importance of Gramsci. And as always, to Patsy Kullberg, our skilled engineer. I'm Clayton Morgeridge. Remember, you can hear today's show again or any part of it by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you'll find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as to past shows. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. And stay tuned to KBOO for the following. Because at 10 o'clock on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein looks at the impact and lessons learned from last season's megafire in the Columbia River Gorge. At 11, Making Contact explores nonprofit groups who are helping Americans that find themselves parenting from prison. And at 11:30, Madness Radio talks to vegan chef Sabrina Louise about transitioning away from eating animal products while avoiding common mistakes that can undermine health. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee has been rescheduled to July 11th at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th, at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.